Now, there are many questions. The one question, last night you mentioned the importance of developing samadhi to calm the mind and vipassana to open the mind to wisdom. Some teachers recommend developing samadhi to a high degree prior to vipassana practice, while others encourage developing both samadhi and vipassana together. Could you comment on this? All right. It is very profitable for some persons to practice vipassana, samadhi at first. If they are weak in keeping mind on one point, let them practice samadhi at first. And some people like to attain to higher states of jhanas, and some people even like to attain to psychic powers after practicing jhanas. And then, depending on samadhi, they practice vipassana. This is called samadhi padaka vipassana. This method was followed at the time of the Buddha, even at the time of the Buddha. In our text, it is mentioned samadhi padaka vipassana. That method also is right. And some persons, without practicing samadhi at all, start vipassana. But without samadhi, there is no vipassana. While they are practicing vipassana, there is samadhi working. It is called khanika samadhi, momentary samadhi. They also develop vipassana and samadhi together. Well, any method you like, you choose. You must select any method that is left to you. But both are correct. The mental level of people are not the same. Some people like samadhi at first. Some people like to start vipassana at first. In whatever way you may go, at last you come to the same goal. Through samadhi, then vipassana. Or directly vipassana, but accompanied by momentary samadhi. So both methods are correct. But selection is left to you. That is your wish. traditionally, it is taught that high levels of dhyana, concentration, are necessary in order to successfully penetrate vipassana, practice vipassana. In recent times, certain Burmese teachers are teaching that only relatively low levels of concentration are needed to practice vipassana to liberation. Would you please come on? Well, these questions don't rise if they thoroughly read the text. Both the methods are right. If you like to practice samatha to the highest level, and then depending on samatha, jhana, you can practice vipassana. I'll explain. Now there are 8 jhanas. Suppose you have, you practice jhana and attain to first jhana. When you attain to first jhana, you feel much glee and joy and peace in your heart, never before we had experienced. So we have much attachment to that first jhana. You think you have attained to Nibbana or something like that. Such a great and deep peace is there in the first jhana. Because this is the first thing that you, first experience of such a state. So, the Vipassana teacher advises him, try to examine the qualities of first jhana, the nature of first jhana. And the experiencer of the first jhana. Who experiences first jhana? This mind. Jhana mind. Jhanic mind. Examine jhanic mind. Whether it is the same forever. Examine jhanic qualities, mind's characteristics, vitakka, vichara, and so on. When the meditator goes on examining these qualities at last, he finds first jhana is a simple thing, and it is subject to, all its parts and qualities are subject to impermanence. They are impermanent. There is no real happiness. It is temporary peace. For some time this peace lasts, but again if you are unmindful, you fall away from that state. So he sees very many weaknesses of this first jhana. Then he turns his jhana to vipassana. Then he examines his mind, vipassana, jhana mind. Its qualities, whether they are permanent or not, he examines. Then he comes to know they are impermanent, anicca, and anatta, dukkha. Then depending on that knowledge, he practices vipassana. He needs not practice vipassana on body, because he has gone beyond that state. Now he has taken for his goal the first jhana. For him, the first most important thing was jhana. Therefore, all the other things he has given up, has no desire for other lower states. Only the jhana he valued very much so far. Therefore, he has to examine that jhana. Then, depending on that, when he sees its weaknesses, then he practices vipassana on first jhana. Then he attains to the vipassana, the levels of vipassana developments. This is called jhana padaka vipassana. Suppose another person develops jhana samadhi to still higher states, fifth state. When he attains that state, he feels, well, this is Nibbana. This is the highest happiness, highest peace. But the meditation teacher, if there is, advises him to examine them. Or he himself tries to examine whether this peace is perfect, not subject to change, whether this jhanic mind is eternal bliss, whether it is permanent, whether there is something unchanging, not subject to change. Carefully he examines. After some examination, he sees this jhanic mind also is subject to change. There are so many weaknesses. Now he discovers them. Then he practices vipassana over them. That means he attains to samadhi, jhanic state, then wakes up, then remembers his jhanic state which he has experienced, then practices anicca nature, impermanent nature of them, or unsatisfactory nature of them, or anatta nature of those jhanic states. So straight away from fifth jhana, he jumps over to vipassana side. Then he develops vipassana. So in this way, after attaining to any jhana, any samadhi stage, depending on that, you can practice vipassana and develop it. But as regards some persons, they don't want to practice jhana. They start vipassana, but naturally, momentary samadhi. That means momentary one-pointedness of mind is there when you practice jhana. And along with that momentary concentration, the vipassana develops. Any method you can select, and there is no mistake there. Both the methods are correct, suitable to their temperament. Very many. What are these? Roaches?
Roaches. Little bugs.
That is not an insect, no?
Yes, right, that invade kitchens.
Yes, yes, yes. Mante, what about the precept of not killing when it involves orchards and things like that? Thank you. Try to avoid killing as much as possible. And this world is a place where you can't live perfectly free from any harm to anybody. That's the nature of the world. You walk, insects are there and they are trampled. They may be killed, but you don't know. You get a disease. Doctor gives the treatment to kill some germs. So what should be done? You have no wishing, you don't wish to kill, but to save your body, save your health, you use that medicine. So in that way, try as much as possible to avoid killing. And Buddha said, it is not outward making, what we call karma, outward action. It is will or volition, chetana, that is karma. Chetana means motive and intention and will, three together we call it chetana. So, will, intention, and motive. If you have to kill anything, that is a karma. But if you don't have such a motive, and if your motive is something else, even though some harm comes to some animal, it is unavoidable. You are not responsible. That's the nature. So, but we must try to avoid such things as much as possible. One day, in this time, when Buddhist countries are in a lot of political difficulty, is it ever correct for a Buddhist monk to make political statement? My personal view is this. Buddhist monk, if he wants to live monk's life, if he remembers the purpose why he has entered the life of a monk. He should not interfere any political work. Because now, for example, you are practicing meditation. While you are doing these things, meditation, how can you join any political party? How can you make statements about politics? Then your thought stream turns towards that, your meditation is broken. Therefore, well, sometimes even monks face some difficult situation because their supporters come and ask what to do now. An instruction. Well, a monk can give his view, not siding with any political party, so that it may not do any harm to anyone. In such a way, he can give some instruction only to take the trouble towards peace. Such advice as a monk can do, but not to grow the political trouble. But in what way the Buddhist monks must get away these political movements? Bhante, in your talk, you mentioned Nibbana as peace of mind. Could you speak about Nibbana as the unconditioned beyond mind? Well, it is a very... If I answer this question, I have to give a long description. If I find time, I'll explain it later. Later means after I answer all the other questions. Please, what is the purpose of existence? Existence of what and whom? Well, you each individual try to exist because you crave for that, and you crave, you want to exist because we have not realized the exact nature of this existence, your ignorance, your avidya. Because of avidya, because of ignorance of the nature, we want to exist and continue this existence. And if you mean by this question, there are so many, the universe is very vast, there is no end, infinite, and why is this universe existing like that? If you mean that question, nobody can answer this question. There is universe, only this much we know. But all the things in the universe are conditioned. Only that much we can say. thank you very much for the most concise explanation of Vipassana I have heard. It inspired my heart. You say it can only be done through and by Vipassana. Does this include Zen and other forms as well? Well, through Zen, if it leads to Vipassana line, Zen also can do it, because Zen also is a part of Vipassana method. There are many methods, not the same method. We Theravada bhikkhus are not against Zen method. Please, how can this difference between surrender and loss of determination be distinguished? Or discerned? Surrender. Well, why do you want to surrender if it is with regard to meditation? There is nothing to do to surrender. What you have to do, just to understand your nature. When you should not try to suppress any passion or do such a thing. Instead, you have to understand your nature. When you understand your nature, naturally those possibility for passions to rise up go away. In conventional language we use surrendering, suppressing and destroying passions and so on. That is the way of convention. But actually we should not try to kill passions. We have to develop understanding, then naturally passions are killed. Passions will be gone. I don't know whether I have understood your question. Is there any way that dukkha, dissatisfaction, what is this? I can't read this. It's not clear. It's satisfaction.
Serves us as well as hinders
right,
us.
Right. Oh, yes. That dukkha. Serves us. As well as hinders us. Yes. According to the way you look at dukkha, you can utilize it, and you then dukkha may serve you in one way. Suppose you are under some trouble. You are suffering from some disease, which is a dukkha. Then you think, this is the nature of this body. Therefore, we should not crave, we should not desire for existence or to continue in the world like this. We must try to get rid of this state as early as possible. So if you think in this way, that suffering stage will help you to get away from suffering. It will serve or it will not serve according to the way you think of it. Why was it, when so many people were enlightened during the Buddha's life and continued to teach, that the teaching did so much? Why was it when so many people were enlightened and during the Buddha's life? A Buddha appears on the earth when there are so many people mentally mature enough to understand him. If people are in a very lower stage of development, even Buddha can't do anything. But if the highly developed people are there, and if they are able to understand the Dhamma, then a Buddha appears. If Buddha does not appear on such a time, then those people, they again fall away from that state and they will be lost. Therefore, Buddha finds an opportunity, finds a proper time to appear on the earth. So, at the time of the Buddha, many people there were who could understand him, who developed in their former lives, developed meditation and so on, gathered much experience from their past lives. Such developed people were there many at the time of the Buddha. Therefore, many attained to enlightenment. I think it is said that one of the factors that rises in each moment is a life force. I think it is said that one of the factors that arises in each moment is a life force. Would you please explain what that is? I think it is that one of the factors that arises in each moment is a life force. These factors, I mean, these factors of enlightenment, perhaps. Now, self-confidence, effort, and so many factors of enlightenment there are. When you practice vipassana, these factors little by little develop in your mind and gradually they develop. If one factor is developed naturally, together with it, others also develop. Now, at this moment, my self-confidence develops, I suppose. If self-confidence develops at this moment, together with that, my effort, virya, my mindfulness, sati, and such qualities also develop together. You have to grasp only one good quality to develop. Along with that, there are many rise up developing. That is the way of vipassana development. There seems to be a in the West, feeling in the West that we can be in the world jobs, families, and work towards liberation? Are we dulled to think that this is possible? Is liberation possible without renunciation of worldly attachments? Now, in short, the questioner asked that you have so many engagements, you have to attend to so many things, attend to your family life and many things. While doing these things, can you attain to enlightenment? Can you attain to the highest level of development? Well, if you want to attain to such states, there is no impossibility. You can attain to some higher levels of practice of vipassana. Now, at the time of Buddha, the householder Anathapindika, he was a busy man, a trader, but when Buddha spoke to him and explained Dhamma, he attained to the first stage of holy path, Sotapatti, the path of entrance. And that lady Visakha, when she was a child, she listened to the Buddha, she attained to the path of enlightenment, that is the first entrance to the path of enlightenment, Sotapatti. And she lived household life and lived family life. King Hattalavaka, he governed his country, a small country, but he practiced vipassana. He had attained to anagami stage, non-return stage, very high stage, but still he governed his country very righteously. So, even while you are engaged in doing your works, your businesses and so on, if you practice, at least if you reserve a short, some hours to practice vipassana, you can gradually develop it. So, household life is not an obstacle for the development of vipassana. Dear Venerable Maitreya, this is a question about the best practice to do at the time of death, when death comes slowly rather than suddenly, so that one can die consciously, deliberately. If someone has access to jhanas, though samatha practice, through samatha practice, is it better to dwell in deep concentration at the moment of death, or is it better to practice vipassana? The Mahaparinibbana Sutta says that the Buddha, at the time of his passing away, moved up through all of the rupa and arupa jhanas, then drawn through them all, and then passed away from one of the jhana state. Should someone follow this example, insofar as one is able to follow it? Well, if you have developed jhana, you can do it. Everybody can do it. But there is one thing. Suppose you have attained to jhana. At the jhana stage, you don't die. Because your mind is fixed on something. So, if you understand that your death is near, that means your physical body is weak, too weak to live more than you feel, now I am nearing death, then you have already practiced jhanas, you can attain some jhana. By jhana, you suppress the feeling of physical body, the pain of physical body, that death pain, you can overcome it by attaining to jhana. And then you wake up from jhana, then physical body is in a peaceful mode, and then you pass away. Always after getting out of, waking from a jhana stage, you pass away. Not while you are within that state. Buddha also attained to some jhanas, and at last he attained to fifth jhana or fourth jhana. Then woke up from it and passed away. If you have attained to jhanas, then you can do it. That's a better way, if you can do it. Let alone higher jhanas. Now, when you practice this vipassana, there is some amount of concentration. When death moment comes, practice little vipassana. Then you feel some slight one-pointedness at the moment. And then you stop vipassana, you would pass away peacefully. You made a distinction between heart and mind. Could you say more about this distinction? Is there one? Well, in the East, we use the word mind, not the word heart. In the West, heart is the term. Sometimes they speak about emotions and so on. So I have to use both the words, heart and mind, or heart or mind. For me there is no difference whether we call it heart or mind, it is mind itself. There is no difference between them. This heart means not that physical heart. That state of mind which receives emotions. It is mind itself. Bhante, in the West, and Middle East, for countless generations, spiritual practice has given considerable attention to the will and attributes of a God who must be pleased. Buddhist spiritual practice involves now such attention. Please give us your experiences with the Divine. How can so many people over so many centuries come to such difference conclusions? Well, in the East and in the West also, they practice a kind of prayer, different types of prayer, and also, as far as I have read, a kind of concentration on God. Now, what is this God? They imagine something as God. That is how I have understood. Imagine, they have none of them seen God. They imagine something, some state as God, some form, and they fix their mind on that, and make prayer to that, and concentrate that. That is something imagined. So, even though you imagine something and fix your mind, through that, you develop concentration. It is not by the power of that imagined thing that you get to some high state of mind, some high level of mind. It is because of the power of concentration. That does mean that that imagined thing is existing, whom you call God. Suppose you have this vessel here. Concentrate it. Look at it. Fix your mind it. Forget all other things. And take a copy of this, mental copy of this one into your mind. When you close your eyes, you see this. And then fix your mind that mental form. Try to fix your mind and that form, looking at it mentally for a long time, for hours and hours. Then your mind becomes concentrated. Because of this concentrative power, you can develop some psychic states. It is not the power of this vessel, it is the power of your concentration. Likewise, many people in those countries, they imagine something as God, and they develop concentration and attain to some states. That is the power of concentration, not power of the thing they had imagined. But these stages they have developed, they have never attained vipassana development. They have never, by those methods, never come to realization. They could not remove from their belief, from their heart, the belief in Atta. Still there is Atta with them. So they have not come to full realization, they have developed some grades of jhana, some lower grade of jhana by that, and they enjoyed it as a bliss. Since there is no solid, unchanging self to which all happens, and since we are made up of consciousness which arises and passes away in each moment, as an object of consciousness, does this same? What or who is it that experiences Nibbana? Also, does one who experiences Nibbana experience it at all times, or just when in meditation? That is Nibbana as the conditioned, as the unconditioned, at all times. Is Nibbana playing alongside the normal consciousness, object of consciousness, experience? And if not, how does it work? Very, very complicated question. Well, I understand this. If there is a series of thoughts rising and vanishing, and there is no one thought, there is no person, then who experiences Nibbana? I think he suffers from this question. Well, every thought that is fixed on Nibbana, that has seen Nibbana, is experiencing Nibbana. In Sotapatti stage, that Sotapatti consciousness arises several times, and sometimes you enter what we call samadhi, that is Lokottara samadhi, samapatti we call it. Then you fix your mind on Nibbana and stays there hours and hours. Sometimes one full week your mind is fixed on Nibbana and remains there. That is experiencing Nibbana, experience the bliss of Nibbana. By this practice, even your weaknesses, your diseases also are cured. Mostly Arahants and Buddha did it. If one has had a strong experience of anatta, is it helpful to remember and reflect upon that experience? Is using thoughts as a primary meditation object suitable for some people. Now, first question, if one has had a strong experience of anatta, is it helpful to remember and reflect upon that experience when you wake up from that state? You can remember it. Then you have to reflect it also. It is said in the instructions of meditations that if you experience some state while practicing vipassana, and then after you stop that practice and wake up, then remember what you have experienced and reflect on that. Then try to understand whether you have attained to a high state or whether you have not attained to that state. Examine the state you have experienced. You have to do it. The other question is using thoughts as a primary meditation object suitable for some people. Some developed people, highly developed people, it may be possible. Some of his thought or an object he sees through his thought can be an object for his meditation if he can do it. But he must have the instruction from a clever guide. May your good health continue. You heard the end of your talk. Near the end of your talk, you said of you realize this properly, that concepts are just names for constantly changing mental and physical phenomena. You come to a stage when you never forget this fact. You come to a state where you see very clearly exact state, and you see changing states in different forms, then no passions arise, then perfect knowledge has arisen in you, and with that knowledge wisdom arises and ignorance is rooted out. So, I never forget this means you keep seeing changing states in every day, all the time. Then no passions arise means your mind is in a state of equanimity. No grasping or no aversion. Realize this properly means very deeply. no doubt. Thank you for coming. I enjoyed listening. Well, if you practice this meditation and think most often about the nature of mind, then your passions are suppressed. Now, I don't claim I am arahant, perfect person. No, I have not attained to that state. Well, I see, when I think, I see and examine and think of the nature of body and mind, I have come to a certain understanding, certain amount of understanding of our life, that nobody can mislead me. So far I have gone in my practice. I have also practiced Vipassana under several teachers. I practiced Vipassana myself long ago, from my young days, and later I practiced Vipassana according to Mahasisayadu, under his people, Venerable Sujata. And again, I want to try the other methods I practiced under Goenka. So, by so many ways of practicing, I have gathered some knowledge, some experience that I can, that passions might not arise easily within my heart. Oh, that Nibbana question.
Bhante, we should be aware of the time, both with the Nibbana question, and I know that there's another couple of other piles of questions. So we should also.
So we have to postpone Nibbana question.
I think that that's probably a good idea, because I know that your insights on Nibbana are wonderful. But
so then I need not explain it.
Possibly later this afternoon.
Later after.
I think so, Bhante.
Now what's the time?
It's 5 minutes before 11.
So we have no time.
Right now, that's my understanding. Yes.
All right. Then all the other questions will be answered after meal.
We'll try, yes.
Immediately after meal.
We'll discuss it upstairs.
Okay, we'll discuss it upstairs and...
Yes. Okay. Well, I'm not tired. if you don't feel sleepy, immediately after your meal, I can come. And as for me, immediately after my meal, I don't want any rest. I can come and talk to you. All right. I'll do it in that way. I keep